Blog Talk Radio.
Your Partner in Success Radio is a free business podcast with host Denise Griffiths. It's all about great stories, conversation, and context to help you move your business and life forward with actionable tips and advice from her guest experts. To listen and subscribe, just find us on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you consume your podcasts.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and today I welcome to the show the Director of Ethical Imperatives, Jonasson Goldson. Now, Jonasson is a keynote speaker, a TEDx presenter. In fact, I think he just came back from presenting at TEDx, and he is a community rabbi, as well as a recovered hitchhiker and circumnavigator, love that, former newspaper columnist, and a retired high school teacher in St. Louis. He's the author of hundreds of articles applying ancient wisdom to modern culture and five books, including Fix Your Broken Windows, a 12-step program for promoting ethical affluence. So in this episode of Your Partner in Success Radio, he is going to share what he means when he uses the term ethical affluence. And we were talking in the green room about the difference between ethical affluence and ethical influence. We're going to talk about that a bit. How ethical affluence is the answer to everything, why compliance is often the enemy of ethics, and why the answers to modern problems can be found in ancient teachings. Sorry, I'm trying not to sneeze. It's pollen season. And are there benefits to an ethical mindset that extends beyond the workplace? Good morning, Jonasson. Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm happy to have you here.
Good morning, Denise. It's my pleasure.
Okay, tell us very quickly, weren't you on the road just recently to a TEDx?
On the road, literally. I drove almost 900 miles each way to Colorado Springs from St. Louis, where we had our TEDx conference on Sunday. The theme was frontiers, from charting new horizons, breaking new ground, getting out of our comfort zone. And I have to tell you, it really exceeded my expectations. I thought I was going there for me to speak, which I did. But the chemistry among the speakers, the engagement, enthusiasm of the audience, and then the general attitude of people who want to share new ideas to try and make the world a better place. It was really an extremely uplifting and inspiring experience.
I'm glad to hear that. I have a lot of friends and colleagues, and I interview a lot of people who have done or are getting ready to do a TEDx, and they all say the same thing across the board, that it was just a tremendous experience. So I'm glad that happened for you. Congratulations.
Yeah. Thank you. But even for, even if you don't want to give a TEDx talk, just to be part of the audience, part of the experience, people seem to come away from it feeling that it was definitely worth the price of admission and much more.
Mm-hmm. Well, I got hooked on TEDx talks when I think the first one I saw, was, and I can't remember, I'm trying to think what her name is. It's like the number one, I just drew a blank, I'm sorry.
Brene Brown, probably?
No, it's not Brene Brown. It's a Harvard educator. Gosh, what was her name? I'll have to come back to it. I'll have to look it up because she does the Wonder Woman pose.
You know, that's Amy Cuddy,
Amy Cuddy, thank you. My brain just walked out the door. I just waved goodbye and left. But I, once I saw that one, I went, oh, my gosh. And I keep going back to it. I don't know how many times I've watched it. And then I started watching other TEDx's, and some resonate, obviously, more than others, but some just stick with you like hers does. And, you know, Mel Robbins did a tremendous TED Talk. Love her. So I'm a big fan of TED Talks. I'm really glad you had the opportunity to do that.
Yeah, I'm very grateful.
Yeah. Okay, so listen, let's go ahead and let people know a bit about you because I introduced you a little bit. You're a circumnavigator. What a recovered hitchhiker and circumnavigator. I keep thinking of a book I used to read, but how did you recover from that? I mean, wanderlust is not
exactly.
You typically recover from.
It's from a theological point, and I won't dwell on this, but You know, we believe that our souls are exiled to the physical world, and so this is where that wanderlust comes from, or that basic dissatisfaction. You know, when it's unhealthy, people look for new jobs constantly, look for new life partners, always think that if I get to go somewhere else or do something different, life's going to get better, because we have this yearning to connect to something greater than ourselves. And the way to recover from that is by finding a direction in life that we feel purposeful, we feel we're contributing, we feel we are connected to something greater, not that we have to be at the end point, but that we're helping bring about a closeness to that goal, to that ideal. Goes back to what we're talking about with the TED Talks, the idea that I'm trying to make the world a better place. And of course, so after in my college days and my post-college days, I did quite a bit of traveling. I eventually ended up in Israel, where I reconnected with my heritage. I'd grown up with really no knowledge of Judaism whatsoever. Ended up staying in Israel for 9 years, became a rabbi, taught Jewish education for 23 years. And now I'm trying to take the ideals, not in a religious context, but the values, the deep spiritual essence of what it means to be a vibrant, healthy, and happy human being, and apply that to the professional world, which is how I came onto my theme of ethics and my expression of ethical affluence, because the sages say, who is wealthy? The one who's happy with what he has. And when we live ethical lives and we create ethical communities, that's how we become truly rich. That's how we have the sense of value and happiness in our lives that really makes life worth living, and really does help us recover from that natural wanderlust that is always making us look on the other side of the fence.
It really does start with you. I think some people miss that somehow. If you can't, I don't know, correct your stinking thinking, if you will, because we all suffer from that. You know, we all talk to her. I said, listen, I'll be very frank with you. If I spoke to another living person in some of the ways I have been known to speak to myself, I'd be flat on the ground with a bloody nose. They would belt me, and I wouldn't blame them. So you have to kind of start with yourself, don't you?
Yeah, you really said that beautifully. You know, all of the all
I'm
the gurus tell us.
Violence. I don't want to get hit.
Yeah, well. Yeah, the gurus are always talking us about the self-talk, and we're so down on ourselves, and we doubt ourselves, and then we start doubting those around us, and we find ways of looking at the negative and everything, and you know, I say. You know, it's not that people complain because they're unhappy. It's they're unhappy because they complain so much. I mean, when you listen to somebody else complain, you just want to get away from that person. So if I'm complaining in my own head all the time, I want to get away from me. And that doesn't usually work very well.
Sorry, I hit the wrong button there. Can you hear me now?
Okay. Yes, I can.
Okay, sorry. No, you're exactly right about that. And people, I find this a lot, and I want to know if you do as well. People will say, hey, how are you doing? And if you immediately, and I've had it happen to me, they immediately launch into a litany of, oh, you know, my cat died. Oh, really? You can't just say, hey, everything is great. How about you? Thank you for asking. And how about you? Let it go. And I know it's not easy to, your cat died, that's not easy to let go. But not everybody is going to care. In fact, most people are not going to care, to be honest with you. So I have developed a habit over my life when somebody says, Denise, how are you doing? I may have just slammed my finger in the car door. I'm fine. I'm not going to want to cry about it because that just makes my finger hurt more because now I'm drawing attention to it. So. I mean, do you find that as well when people just immediately go, oh, you know, I have a sick headache, or, you know, I just don't feel all that good. Part of me wants to say, really, is there anything I can do to help? And the other part's going, really? Just stop. So I'm always at war with myself when people act like that.
Well, you know, we were talking earlier before the show about etiquette. And it's having that social sensitivity to know when it's proper. You know, I have close friends that I can vent to when I need to.
See, that's what I was trying to say. and you just said it perfectly. You distilled my whole little rambling down into one sentence. Thank you.
That's why I'm making the big bucks, right? you know, in the office, in a casual coming and going, it's just that's not the time to start dumping on the first person who has the misfortune of asking you how you're doing. And on the other hand, I've often thought we should sort of try to rephrase the way we greet people, because how you doing is really an invitation for people. We have to recognize that we don't always mean what we say. And that when that becomes the norm, then my responsibility is to be sensitive that the person who gave me casual greeting is not really looking for a diatribe about all the ills that I'm suffering in the world. On the other hand, we have to know. Yeah.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. That's a good way to describe it. You have to be aware of what's really going on in the conversation. I mean, some people really do need to dump on you, and if you're willing, listen and try to, you know, help. Sometimes just listening helps. But other times, it's just not appropriate. And I think we need to figure out what's appropriate and when, and be aware and be present in the moment.
Yeah, exactly. And the theme of my TED Talk actually was what I call ethical communication. And part of that is being upfront and honest. If I say, yeah, do you have a couple of minutes? I really need to vent.
Okay, did I lose you?
Right now, I don't have the time, or I'm not in the mood. Or sure, let's sit down for a minute and you get off your chest.
There you go. And it really does help. I remember when I was a child growing up, one of my grandmothers was a whiner. There's just no other way to describe her. And she was frankly unpleasant to be around. And I learned a lot of lessons from her, mostly how to not respond to a lot of different things, because it was just so irritating. And she never knew it, God bless her. She just didn't. She, you know, it was just who she was, what she did. But I learned to kind of keep things inside because I didn't want to be that person. Yeah, you know, so there's some childhood lessons there that maybe we need to overcome. Maybe we just need to figure out what is appropriate.
Yeah, and I have a couple of people that I'm friendly with that they walk in the room, or I see them from the other side of the room, and I just feel better. Because they always look happy, and they don't even have to say anything. It's just the room brightens up when they walk in, and I think I want to be one of those people. And the way to be one of those people is to, if I'm constantly, I'm sure we've all had this. You've had it. I can think of a couple of incidents where I had some very unpleasant exchanges or incidents or episodes. And I keep reliving them over and over and over in my own mind. And it was bad enough to have to go through it once, but to have to go through it repeatedly for days and days and days. Now, I'm making myself miserable. So I'm not going to be a magnet for pleasantness. People are going to see on my face and hear in my voice that I'm in a lousy mood, and that's going to distance people from me. And when we apply it to a business setting, we want to work with people who are upbeat, who are positive, who bring positive energy. So it's not just about me. I could be having my issues, whatever they are, but I have to be able to compartmentalize to some degree and keep things in perspective. If my father just died, that's serious. That's something to mourn over. But if it's just the day-to-day bumps and scrapes of life, we have to be able to manage those in a way they don't eclipse everything that's good in our lives.
Exactly. And you know what I found out, and I'm sure you found this out as well, almost one of the worst things you can tell somebody, you know, whether it's on the phone, because you're right, people can hear in your voice. And I'm on the phone a lot of the time because I work remotely. My office is in my home. I don't need to be front and present, face to face with my clients. And I have found over time, over the years, that if I just all of a sudden, I'm just so busy, and I'm, just blah, 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 how busy I am, it's actually offensive to the person that's speaking to me. I have mortally offended a couple of people doing that, not realizing, and that goes back to you know, talking about my grandmother, she's always whining about how she didn't feel well. I caught myself whining about how just terribly busy I was, and I was just so self-important. I think I lost a friend over it at one point. You just, let's talk about that a bit, because yes, we're all busy, but there's a point where you just shut up and listen to the other person on the phone or in front of you, and just, it's not really about you, is it?
No, it's. I mean, what's the term that's become so popular, that emotional intelligence? Because there's a kind of biofeedback that goes on, whether it's psychological or emotional or even spiritual, that we affect one another. You know, there's a whole discussion about what I talked about this in my keynotes, what the neurologists are calling mirror neurons, that level. If I look at you and smile, chances are you're going to smile back. And we're told that smiling actually has a neurological effect, the physiological effect to make us happier. If you see someone eating ice cream, the same neurons that are firing in that person's brain eating the ice cream are firing in yours. It's just your taste buds are telling your brain there's nothing going on. Don't get too excited. But there is this reciprocity of mood. And when we behave in a way that's upbeat, thinking of my theme, when you behave in a way that's ethical, we encourage people on a subconscious level to up their game.
Okay, for some reason you keep breaking up. Can you repeat that? Because you just disappeared for about half a sentence there.
Oh, my goodness. When we act and speak in a way that is upbeat, pleasant, and ethical, then we encourage those people.
Okay, it keeps happening. I'm really concerned that the audience is only hearing part of this conversation. Can you hear
me
okay?
Let me try. I hear you fine. Let me try something else.
Okay.
Go ahead and see what happens.
Yeah.
That sound like it might be better?
We'll keep trying.
Okay.
Let's go ahead and do this. You keep on talking, and if we're still having the same problem, what we can do, excuse me, is shut this one down and do this another day, like Monday or something. Just make sure that people are really getting the full conversation, because what you have to share is important.
Okay. Well, let me try it one more time.
Yeah, let's keep going.
Yeah. The we tend to respond to the moods, to the attitudes, to the speech patterns, and to the behavior of those around us. And so if I take responsibility for my mood, for my actions, for my ethical conduct, then I'm making it easier for people around me to hold themselves to a higher standard. If I'm pleasant, people around me are likely to be pleasant. If people witness me acting ethically and they witness fair play from me, it has a psychological effect that they tend to assume that this is the way they should be acting, even if they're not making that decision consciously. But when we lower the bar, contribute to an environment where standards continue to slip, and we can see plenty of that in the world, the ethics scandals that become worse and worse, what passes for political debate in the country that really is just sort of gladiatorial combat in the newsroom. We really do have a profound ability to influence the world we live in simply by expecting more from ourselves and being more sensitive. How do I want people around me to act? That's the way I should be acting towards them. And the likelihood is that they will start to mirror my behavior. So when I don't like what I see in other people, the first place to start looking is at myself.
I can't remember who said this, but basically the thought is that you are the sum total of the five people that you hang around the most. You know, if you're hanging around with wealthy people, you're probably kind of in their group, if you will. If you're hanging around with people who are robbing grocery stores, you know, you're probably going to become more like them. or to put it more mildly, water seeks its own level. So I understand what you're saying. It's very, very important that you hang around with people that, you know, kind of share what it is that you're doing, but it's also important that if you see something that just doesn't set well with you, that rather than get angry or get nasty, you just teach by example. I think that's what I'm hearing you say.
Yeah, absolutely. And the people we hang around with, many of them are online, whether it's whether it's Facebook or chat rooms or just the things we watch, whether they're TV shows or movies or YouTube videos. We really need to be disciplined in what we expose ourselves to, because you know it's violence, it's profanity, it's you know crimes or shows about people committing crimes. These have a subtle effect, and you know we can all agree, I hope, that the pornography is not healthy for us, but once it gets more gray, then we start making excuses for ourselves. We start saying, "Well, it's not so bad. I'm just relaxing. I'm just unwinding." But we need to have discipline in every aspect of our lives and be willing to say to myself, "Is this something that's actually going to be beneficial for me, or could I be finding my entertainment in a healthier way, in a way that's going to actually help me develop a greater sense of refinement?"
This is true. I cut cable probably 5 or 6 years ago, and I don't watch much TV anyway. I actually find it tedious. My brain doesn't shut down enough for me to just sit in front of a television or even a movie. A movie will put me to sleep quicker than anything, but I just really don't enjoy it. But I had cable, don't know why I had it, and it was costing me a ton. But what I found out was that when I would watch the news, I would become agitated, really agitated, and it would stick with me for a while. And I finally just said, look, I don't want this in my home. I don't want this in my brain. I will go find the news that I want to see or hear. Then I will do my due diligence, find out if it's true or not, or these days, wait 3 days while they sort it out and tell the truth. And I just cut it off, and I want you to know I was instantly healthier. Instantly. It was amazing.
No surprise.
None of this garbage programming that comes into the house, none of the garbage news. I don't believe the news most of the time anyway. And plus, I was saving $150 a month. It was a win-win. But I could, within a couple of days, I was like, oh. You know, and it really comes down to garbage in, garbage out, doesn't it?
Yeah, and I think I was listening to an interview with Seth Godin, and I believe, if I remember correctly, he said he doesn't watch TV. He doesn't watch movies. He's busy. he's got other stuff going on in his
life. Okay, we are still breaking
he is.
Up. I mean, we're breaking up. I'm hoping that people can kind of fill in the blanks. But you're right. I mean, give me a stack of books, I'm happy. Give me a movie, I'm like, I tried to watch a movie not too long ago. This is the fifth time I've tried to watch it. I keep washing dishes or doing laundry or leaving the room. Just that's not how my brain operates. But books, I'm happy with those. So I wanted to go back before we get too far down the road. I wanted to go back to the term that you use, ethical affluence. What is the difference between, first of all, I want you to explain what you mean by that. And then what is the difference between ethical affluence and ethical influence? Because we hear an awful lot about influencer these days, especially on, online.
Yeah. So let's just circle back to what I was saying earlier, that you can find plenty of people who seem to have it all. If you remember the poem that by Edward Arlington Robinson that Paul Simon turned into a song, Richard Cory. It is such a compelling short poem about how these mine workers see this fellow Richard Cory, who just has it all. He's good looking, he's tall, he's got the women flirting with him, he's got incredible wealth, he's friends with all the right people, and they're going about their miserable lives, and he goes home one night, puts a bullet in his head. We create these fantasies of what's supposed to make us happy.
and what's supposed to be real wealth. And I think I quoted already, the sages say that who is wealthy? The one who's happy with his portion. When we find happiness in the value of our lives, then we are truly wealthy. Then we are satisfied. You can see people that seem to have very little, and you might think they have no reason why they should be happy. And they have family, they have community, they have self-respect, they have integrity. And that's really what ethics does for us. Ethics gives us a profound sense of self-worth. I am a person of quality. I am a person of refinement. I am a person who's making a positive contribution in this world. And the people that I associate with, my family, my community members, my coworkers, they recognize that in me, and they appreciate me for that. I mean, now we're talking about a person who is truly affluent, who's truly wealthy. Now, the term ethical influence, if I'm living my life that way, then I will be influencing those around me. People will see me and they'll say, I want to be like him. I want him to want me to be around him. I want to be part of his inner circle. And therefore, I have to be worthy of being in his company. This is really how we can transform a society. But what we see way too much of is just the opposite. People thinking that I have to sacrifice my ethical standards because that's how you get ahead in the world. Nice guys finish last, and no good deed goes unpunished, and all these cynical aphorisms that we see playing out again and again. It is so corrosive to our society. And you know, people can't talk to each other civilly. They can never agree to disagree. They can't find common ground. You have the tribalism. You have the groupthink, where I'm only able to see the world my way, and anybody who doesn't agree with me is evil. We undermine the quality of our own lives and our own society because we compromise our ethical standards because we think that's what we need to do to get ahead, when really it's exactly the other way around.
And I'm listening to you, and I'm thinking, I tend to lurk in social media and kind of find out what people are doing, what they're thinking, and people are getting nastier. Is this just my imagination? It just seems like people are just getting more and more vicious. And it really bothers me. I don't bother to get mad about it because they are not my problem. I mean, they're not attacking me personally, and if they did, we'd have words. But I don't let it bother me. I don't take it personally is what I'm trying to say, I think. But I watch it, and some of these are people that I've known for a long time, and all I can do is say, what happened to you? What in the heck happened to you? It's frightening. I mean, it's almost like we're devolving as human beings rather than evolving. And that scares the bejeebers out of me.
Yeah. And it's part of the, the commercialism of society, that the way to get people's attention is to be edgy. And if you go back to the early days of television, I Love Lucy and the Dick Van Dyke Show. There was a whole debate.
Yeah.
But they had rules on the Federal Communications had rules about bedroom scenes. That if you had what's his name, Dick Van Dyke and Mary Tyler Moore, if they're in the bedroom, only one can be sitting on the bed, and they have to have at least 1 foot on the floor.
And twin beds, I think.
Yeah, and twin beds, exactly, right?
Right.
Because it was felt that any suggestion of beyond that was inappropriate for television. Now, you can argue about whether you think that's going too far or not, but now there's virtually no line anywhere. You can say anything, you can do anything. And so in the name of freedom of expression, we say that's a good thing. But what's the effect on us when we have no boundaries? When we keep pushing the boundaries further and further. In fact, this is one of the things, one of the places where I incorporate the ancient wisdom into my teachings. Like King Solomon says, do not remove the boundaries of eternity that were set in place by your forefathers, right? Because we need boundaries to keep us civil. You know, it's one thing to have laws, which side of the road you have to drive on. We can all understand that. Don't steal. Don't kill. Don't murder. Right? But we have to have boundaries and delineations for our social conduct as well and our moral conduct as well. Because morality and ethics really is what governs the gray area between what's legal and what's illegal. Just because something is not illegal doesn't mean it's right, doesn't mean it's healthy, doesn't mean it's good for us. And keeping that sensitivity is really at the heart of how we remain fully human.
So for people who are listening, if they think they're kind of running down that rabbit hole, look, we've all done it. I'll catch myself, you know, responding in a knee-jerk response to something and go, whoa, 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 whoa. How is this helpful? I mean, what are you doing? Stop and think about, lift your fingers from the keyboard. I always tell people, back off. You know, just the problem exists between the chair and the keyboard. Sometimes you don't need to respond. Sometimes the best thing to do is not respond. But this is really a matter of awareness, isn't it? I mean, don't we have to become aware that we're circling the drain with some of these things that are going on?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, they say if you're in a heated mood and you write an email, don't push the send button.
Leave
right away.
Leave it for 24 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I used to write for the local paper in St. Louis, column. And I remember a particular issue that was very hot at the time. And I sent it to a couple of friends, as I typically did, just to get their impressions before I sent it to my editor. And one friend responds, and in the subject line is of his email, it says, "Do not publish this article."
what did you wind up doing?
Well, so then I read the email, and I didn't really agree with him. And so I wrote him back an email and explained why I didn't agree with him. And I don't remember how many times we went back and forth, but what finally got me was he said, I forget exactly how he phrased it, but it was beautiful. He said, do you want the people you're trying to reach to hear your message? And that got me, because it's easy to preach to the choir. It goes back to the group thing. We can sit in our little echo chamber. We can all have our affirmations. We can tell each other what we want to hear again and again, right? I'll listen to my news channel. You'll listen to yours. And we'll never have the opportunity or give ourselves the opportunity to hear the other side of the issue, to find out whether the other side actually has something to say, because we've already made up our minds they're wrong. And so when he sent me that email, I said, okay, I've got to go back and I've got to figure out how to express what I want to say in a way that people that don't agree with me might be able to hear my message. And that's the question we really should be asking ourselves. If I'm just expressing my passion in a way that is going to drive us further and further apart, then ultimately, am I doing anything that's positive or beneficial? If I'm passionate about something, find a way to explain it in a way that person on the other side can hear it. And one of the really great contemporary examples of this is Jonathan Haidt. Are you familiar with him?
No.
He had a his first book, I think, was about the political divide, and he was a fairly liberal Democrat who wanted to write a book discrediting the conservative Republican line. He had the intellectual integrity to realize that he needed to really research and understand what they were saying if he wanted to responsibly critique their position. And when he did, he found out that they weren't nearly as extreme and as irrational as he had thought they were. And he shifted towards the center. He still considers himself a Democrat, but he's much more moderate now. And at the beginning of his TED talk, it's just the first couple of minutes are so worth watching because he asked the audience, he says, how many of you consider yourselves Republicans or conservatives? And about 10 or 15% go up. How many of you consider yourselves liberals or Democrats? And 85% go up. And he says, this is a problem. And it's not because it's tilted one way or the other. It's because it's so skewed. When we only surround ourselves with people who think like us, then we never have the opportunity to discover what the other side's actually saying. And therefore, we aren't balanced in our thinking either. There has to be that willingness to engage and to listen and to express ourselves in ways that others can hear us. And, you know, then we're talking, this is the, that's about politics, but it's the same thing in our professional lives. You look at some of the great economic disasters, business disasters, certainly the 2008 economic meltdown, the Challenger space shuttle disaster, Enron was a cutthroat organization where they encouraged the employees to do anything necessary to succeed and get ahead of their coworkers, and that led to the corrosive environment and the unethical environment that eventually destroyed the company.
I know, I remember that. That was terrible. Excuse me. Going back to what you were talking about, it's not necessarily about politics. We all tend to think one way, and we like to think that we're the right way, but I agree with you. I mean, I have had terrific conversations with people who are on the opposite side of the political spectrum as I am, but we're polite about it, and we're very interested in hearing why the other thinks what they're thinking about a particular incident or a particular politician or policy, and we listen very carefully. We may not come to any kind of conclusion where we agree 100% with the other, but we feel better. We're still friends. We understand their positioning and why they think. And, you know, I've had times where I'm like, really? That's how you see that? Okay, let's talk a bit more about that because I really don't understand that. And the more they'll go into it, like, okay, I can kind of see where you're coming from. I'm probably never going to, you know, sway to your side, but I completely understand why you feel that way. Why can't we do more of that? It's not that difficult. Shut up and listen. Basically, just shut up and listen.
One of the quotes I used in my TED talk is from one of the great Jewish thinkers of the last century, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik, and he said that all extremism and fanaticism come from a lack of security. A person who's secure can't be an extremist. When we understand why we believe what we believe, when we've actually worked our way to our beliefs and our values and our ideals rationally, then we feel very secure, and we're not threatened by people who think differently from us. But when we merely absorb them from our environment, from our peers, from our parents, our teachers, or the news media, or the entertainment industry, we don't feel we're on solid footing. We don't have the security of having worked our way to what we believe, and so anyone who disagrees with us is a threat. You know, there's the human ego does not want to admit being wrong or having not thought things through, and so it's much easier to attack the person or attack the label or attack the movement and say, oh, you're just one of those. You're a right-wing fanatic. You're a left-wing fanatic. You're this kind or that kind. We're so wrapped up in how we appear. I mean, when was the last time that you were watching a political debate on television or on the radio or anywhere, and you heard somebody say, you know, that's an interesting point. I hadn't actually thought about it that way. Have you ever heard of anyone saying that?
No, but when I do hear that in real life, I perk up. I'm like, ooh, let's talk. You know,
yeah.
Let's have a conversation here. I get
interested. Now we can get somewhere.
Right.
Yeah, and
so
certainly
I wish more people
business.
Would just kind of back off and listen. Just, you know.
Yeah, well.
Even if you're never going to agree, try to, you know, be polite enough to listen and say, oh, you know, that's interesting. We're not going to agree, but thank you for sharing. Or, let me look into that. You just never know what's going to come up in a genuine conversation.
Right, Right. And think about it in a business sense
I was getting there.
of
That was going to
C
be my next question.
Yeah, I mean the CEO who only wants to surround himself with yes men. People are going to tell him exactly what he thinks. So they're going to make him feel good. But what happens when somebody sees it as a problem and is afraid to speak up, is afraid to handle it, is afraid to deal with the problem, and suddenly the bottom falls out? The first place this is taught is right at the beginning of the Bible. And God says, "Let us make man in our image." Who's he talking to? He's God. It's all up to him. So the sages explain that he's talking to his heavenly court, and he's including them in the decision-making process, right? So if God is willing to bring his underlings into the discussion, then the CEO, who we hope doesn't think he's God, but certainly isn't. First of all, it gives people a sense of empowerment. I'm a team member. My opinion is valued. I'm listened to. I'm contributing. And also, sometimes somebody's going to have something to say that really the CEO never thought of, the boss never thought of. And wow, that's something new. Let's investigate that and see if that's going to change the course that we want to take.
That's exactly right. Now, going back to kind of social media and, how people are responding to, let's just go with political, because right now that's top of mind with everybody. It seems like, yeah, I will listen, I will engage in conversation, but you attack me, and that's the last time you have that opportunity. I don't play. And I think a lot of people are getting that way. It's just like, okay, you can go be nasty somewhere else. I will block you. You will never have access to me again. I'm not sure that's the right answer, to be honest, but it is my kind of knee-jerk response. Like, do not attack me, call me names, tell me I'm stupid, tell me I'm wrong. A conversation is one thing. Flinging things, really ugly words about, that's something else entirely. And what you just told me is that you are of no interest to me because you're not a decent person. Now, am I wrong, or is that, should I do something differently? Because I hate to do it, but I also am very picky about who comes into my circle.
Yeah, and I think we have to give people more than one chance. I've had
No.
a very small
Not
number of
bad. You
exchanges.
told me no.
No?
Probably not. It depends on how egregious the nastiness
Well, of
was.
course, yeah. But I know that in my I got an email once from somebody responding to an article I'd written, and he just lit into me. And so I wrote him back a very polite email saying, "Well, you said this, and here's how I actually addressed it in the article that you're complaining about." And he immediately responded with a very contrite letter, email back. And he said, "I'm very sorry. I read the first paragraph, and I assumed I knew where you were going, and I responded without looking at the whole thing, and then that was wrong on my part. And I read your whole article, and you're absolutely right. And thank you for giving me a chance to be aware." Sometimes, not often, but sometimes you can actually get through to people. I used to, when I had more, I was on forums online where people would comment more. And the profanity that's used in just casual comments, I found very offensive. And I would gently tell people, "You're entitled to any opinion you want to express, but please be civil." And frequently it just resulted in more of a diatribe. But one time a person actually said, "You're absolutely right. Thank you for pointing that out and bringing it to my attention." So I think it's when we talked about being a good model, being a good model can mean sometimes pointing things out to people and giving them a chance to make them right. And then if they're not interested, then you can hit the block and say, "Well, I'm not going to get anywhere with this person."
Yeah, and sometimes you just have to do that. You just look, just because you're on Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter, any of the social media platforms, doesn't mean that people can heap abuse on you, and it sure doesn't mean you can do it to them either. You follow the golden rule. If you don't want your grandma hearing it, don't write it. Don't post it. Just seriously, behave yourself. You know, use some manners, use some ethics. Just be careful, because you know, we do teach people how to treat us, don't we?
Yeah, there's a great quote by Dan Pink. He says, "Treat everyone like your grandmother, and your grandmother has 80,000 Twitter followers."
Exactly. My grandmother has passed, but I'm still careful not to put anything out there that she would just go, "What were you thinking?" So, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you just don't do that.
I mean, even I've gotten...
You have to be careful, but you have to be cognizant of how you are teaching other people, how you are appearing. And you're not everybody's going to like you. That's just the sum total of it. You're not going to have friends all over the world, and you're not going to be an influencer all over the world, unless you're Tony Robbins. But the thing is, you have to show up the best way that you can, and if other people like it, great. If they don't, oh well, not your problem. Larry Wingate, I don't know if you know who Larry Wingate is. He's
a
New York Times bestsellers and a good friend of mine. Love him to death. He's a friend of the show. He's been on multiple times. And I think the first conversation I had with him, this was back in 2010, I believe, and he made a comment, and he was actually paraphrasing a book title that he had read that really kind of explains who Larry Wingate is. And I wrote it down on this old yellowed card. It's pinned up here to my bulletin board. But basically what he said to me is, "What you think of me is really none of my business." And I just sucked in wind, because I've always thought that. I just didn't know there was a phrase to go with it. So, you know, basically, you have to think highly enough of yourself that other people's opinion of you is, yeah, it might be interesting, but it's not going to change how you operate.
Right, right. And if you have that, I mean, that's what integrity really is. Integrity is different from honesty. You know, Stephen L. Carter has a whole book called Integrity. It's definitely worth reading. And it's what we call walking the talk. I mean, it's not just being honest in terms of being accurate, but it means staying true to one's values. It means first having a well-calibrated moral compass, and then living truly according to that. And that means that I have to admit when I'm wrong, I have to admit when people on the other side are right, and I have to engage people in a way that is consistent with the way I want to be engaged and treated by others. And when we do that, people can't help but respect us, even if they don't like us, even if they don't agree with us. And that's getting so rare, and certainly in politics. And we're so obsessed as a nation with politics that that was my biggest problem with the way the country's heading at the moment. It's not the political ideology. It's the lack of political civility, the unwillingness to temper or moderate comments, the unwillingness to even contemplate working together with the other side. Oh, you know, we don't compromise our values. You live in a society that's pluralistic, that people are coming from all different points of view. You got to find a way to make it work, because that's your job. And if we allow that to take over the culture as we are, then we're really heading down a road we don't want to follow.
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Dashboard, it kind of hangs up, and I just look at it and go, am I talking or not talking? Okay, so that leads us back to one of the questions that I had for you is why the answers to modern problems can be found in ancient teachings, because this, I have never seen an atmosphere like this, whether it's political, whether it's in the family. It seems like we are just breaking down all over the place. It's very sad to watch. It's concerning, very, very concerning. And it's not just America. It's all over the world. I catch myself wondering what history has to teach us, because I'm thinking Rome. We're coming apart at the seams.
Oh, yeah. The comparisons with Rome are truly frightening. The bread and circuses.
They're terrifying, yes.
The entitlement culture, the gladiatorials we mentioned, gladiatorial combat is what's entertainment today. You know, King Solomon says, "One who tears a gap in a fence will be bitten by a snake," and it's a, you know, it sounds obvious on the surface, but it's really so much more nuanced than that. Who's safer? Somebody who has a fence around his property that has one hole in it, or somebody who doesn't have a fence at all? So we would intuitively say the person with the 99% of a fence is going to be safer than somebody with no fence. But 99% means I think I'm 99% safe, but that doesn't help me with the one snake that gets in. Mm-hmm. We have this illusion that we're safe when we're not, whereas a person who doesn't have a fence, he knows that he has to be on guard. He knows that he has to be careful. And this is, you know, this is the way that King Solomon phrased what we now talk about as the slippery slope, that the more we make compromises, the more we put ourselves in danger of really slipping over the edge of the cliff. And every little change we make in our behavior, every kind word, every smile, every thoughtful gesture, every time we take interest, every time we speak with civility, every time we listen when someone else is talking, that patches those holes, and that shores up our society. And on the other side, when we are careless, when we think that we're entitled to act any way we want, then we keep chipping more and more holes in the fence, and we really, as we already said, we undermine the foundations of our own society.
And that leads me back to compliance, because it's a tough word for me, compliance. You know, it doesn't mean that you have to fall into line with current groupthink. It doesn't mean that you have to be, you know, there's a lot of laws and rules and regulations I frankly do not agree with, and I don't think you have the right to impose them on me. Chances are I'm not going to comply. You want me to wear a seatbelt? No, it's my car. I paid for it. I don't like seatbelts. I'm claustrophobic. No, it's not, you know. But that's, you know, my little compliance issue. But why do you say that compliance is often the enemy of ethics? Where do we go with that?
Well, because ethics is a mindset. The whole idea of anytime you legislate a law, a rule, you automatically create loopholes for getting around it.
True.
So,
absolutely.
So what
true.
Is? Yeah. So what is compliance? Compliance is the attempted legislation of ethics, and it doesn't work because if I can find a loophole, now I'm in compliance. Well, legally maybe, but ethically certainly not. The letter of the law is never ever going to do the whole job. There has to be a respect for the spirit of the law. What does the law mean? What's the right thing to do? How is my action going to affect others? What if everybody were doing what I'm doing? How would that look? And is that a world I want to live in? Is that a business I want to be part of? Is that a political party I want to associate with? Ethics means that we cultivate the attitude, the mindset, the sensitivity that my actions make a difference in the world and in society, and I'm responsible for continuously asking myself, what's the right thing to do? Mm-hmm. If I'm going to fall back on compliance laws, then I abdicate that moral authority to whoever wrote the compliance laws, which, as you say, may or may not be ethical. But I've relinquished the responsibility to have my own moral compass and to hold myself to a higher ethical standard.
Well, that makes sense. Okay, I wanted to talk, we didn't have this on the list, but I want to ask you about, I think this is your most recent book, Fix Your Broken Windows, a 12-step program for promoting ethical affluence. Let's talk about that a bit, because what I'm hearing from you is that the book really does start and stop with us. We have to promote our own ethical influence. We have to show up as a decent person and convince other people that, you know, being decent is not a bad thing. Try it sometime. So what do you tell people when they're kind of wavering, they're, you know, maybe just getting ickier and nastier and meaner and unhappier. And I've seen it most recently in a couple of people that I've worked with, or they're colleagues of a sort. And I keep thinking, what happened to you? What is going on with you? And it's really sad to watch. I mean, it's a downhill slope, and they're not doing themselves any favors at all, business or personal. You really can't divide the two, I don't think. But what do you tell people if they're going to really become aware of, you know, they're devolving a bit, they're falling into groupthink, they're watching too much TV, they're watching porn, whatever it is that they're doing, where do they take that emotional IQ and put it into play? What do they do? Where should they start?
Well, so the reason I chose the title for the book, Fix Your Broken Windows, is from the famous article in The Atlantic that eventually became public policy in New York City. And they went into these neighborhoods and that were, you know, ridden with crime. And they took down, they boarded up doors, and they towed away the derelict cars, and they covered over the graffiti, and they fixed the broken windows, and they you know, shoot away the unsavory characters hanging out on the corners, and there was a tremendous improvement. Now, there's a lot of debate about exactly how much did the change in culture come from this, but the theory itself is sound, that when you live in a community that looks like there's order, that looks like there are standards, that looks respectable, so you start to feel there's a certain responsibility to live up to those standards. If you live in an environment, or you function in an environment where it's a free-for-all, then you feel there are no boundaries, there are no limits, and I can do whatever I want. So little changes in our behavior, the way we dress. You know, it's nice to say, and you know, if you work in Facebook or Google, I understand it's a completely different culture. But there have been studies that demonstrate that when people dress up at work, they tend to be more productive, at least in a more conventional setting. If we aren't addicted to our phones, meaning that if I'm talking to you face-to-face, I don't answer my phone when it rings. Maybe I'll turn it off.
No, nor do I. Mine's off.
You know, Simon Sinek talks about this. He says, just putting the phone on the table is during a conversation with a human being is saying, I may have to interrupt you because this little box might want my attention. Sharing credit with people, including people in conversations, taking interest in people. We were talking earlier about not venting, but at the same time, if I come into work, I say, hey, what's going on? How you doing? Or if I see somebody who looks like they're having a rough time, you know, is everything okay? So can I do anything to help?
Yeah. Right.
Asking for help is not a sign of weakness. It's a sign of responsibility.
Yeah, that was one of the hardest lessons I had to learn.
I mean, yeah, we all want to do it on our own, and we don't want to be seen as anything less than competent. But, you know, teamwork is going to get you places where individual work almost never will. And also, seeing the big picture, that sometimes, you know, I've had experiences where people blame me for things that either I never did or perceived me as having done something or having intended something that I never did or never intended to do. To presume positive intent, to give people a chance to explain themselves, or miss a pointing out, you know, do you realize that what you did or what you said was not appropriate, was hurtful, was right before you push the nuclear button? I was working in a high school in another city, and the vice principal was sort of agitated, talking to a group of teachers, and I wasn't one of the ones that she was targeting, And I wrote a little note and handed it to her. It said, "You're beautiful when you're mad." Now, this woman was 15 years older than me and my cousin, and we had a very good working relationship, and she wasn't mad at me. I was just trying to dispel a little bit of the tension. And she called me in later, and she said that she spoke to her daughter, the lawyer, to ask whether this was a case of sexual harassment. And I
You're
thought, oh boy.
kidding me.
I wish.
She was pulling your leg, right?
No.
Oh, Lord.
In fact, we just had this in St. Louis. One of the talk show hosts on NPR, this man's 80 years old, and he was interviewing a guest who was a woman who was 75 years old, who was a longtime friend of his that he hadn't seen in years, who had come back to town, and he was interviewing her, and he starts off the interview saying, "How you doing? You look great." And his manager called him in after the show and said that was inappropriate.
This is the kind of stuff that just drives me bonkers. It really
Yeah, well, he quit on the spot. He said, "I'm done," and he walked out.
I don't blame him. I don't blame
Neither do
him.
I. You gotta have a little common sense.
Yeah, and you know that's part of that whole you to me, whatever the heck that was, you know. But and I'm not disparaging it. Well, I kind of am because I mean, if you were allegedly assaulted 30 years ago, time to take care of it would have been back then. So it's I'm probably not going to be terribly sympathetic, but that's, and I probably just offended half the audience, and I apologize for that, but that's how I feel. So listen, we are actually out of time. So tell people where they can find you on the web very quickly. Give us a URL where they can go visit you.
Well, if they can spell my name, jonasongoldson.com, or my business is ethicalimperatives.com, and you can find me there.
Excellent. Jonasson, thank you so much. It's been a distinct pleasure speaking with you, and I thank you for all of the wonderful advice, basically, that you shared with our audience. Excuse me. And before we say goodbye, I would like to remind our audience to be sure to look for us on iTunes and anywhere else you consume your business podcasts. Just look for Your Partner in Success Radio and take us along on your success journey. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here today.
Get your voice heard. If you would like to launch your own far-reaching podcast, contact Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com and go to the podcast tab.